charges were loaded. The sacks of grain. So the sack house was next to it. So you have the old technology loading grain by sacks, and then you have the new technology of loading grain by elevators. And so it's kind of that, we were able to preserve that site. It was the last site on the Mississippi in St. Paul related to the city's early port city history. So now it's been preserved as a restaurant. You'll be able to see when you go by.
I know. I remember seeing that place empty for years and years. So who actually runs it now? It's a private company.
The city of St. Paul leased it out to a private company.
Any good?
I haven't been there yet this year. It was Red River Kitchen last year, and it was good then.
Yeah.
Basically, your beers and brats and stuff like that. I saw people sitting out there when I went by earlier. Oops, sorry. That's what I mean by it. It's got like... It doesn't have a transition. I just want to make sure I'm not picking up too much of a weight.
Yeah.
Since we have National Park Service signs on the side of the boat, saying to everybody who we are. And we are in a no wake zone until we get to the bridge up there, so I can't go any faster.
This was all flooded in the spring, right?
Huh?
And this was all flooded in the spring.
Yeah, the island was flooded over. I got great pictures of it. I walked across the bridge. The island was underwater. We're at a stage of about 9.3 maybe right now. And it would have been 18 maybe.
Another 9 feet of water.
Which was this whole island flooded?
What?
This whole island is flooded.
Yeah, the island, there was a... The pavilion was an island by itself.
Not record flood, but it was getting up there.
And that pavilion was designed by Cap Wigington, I want to say.
Yep.
First African American city architect in the country.
Yep.
The pavilion there.
So there are marks on it showing high water in various flood stages during flood.
I'll take you over close to the Sack House, now a restaurant. We maybe get a look at the people eating lunch, late afternoon lunch.
So that was, are you saying that was the first grain elevator on the river?
It's,
or just the first one up in here
up,
in this area?
It's the first one up here, but it's one of the first ones. When the Corps comes up the Mississippi on a survey trip in the 1920s, they can't find any terminals to unload anything. In 1917, by 1917, through commerce on the Mississippi, any commerce from St. Paul to St. Louis is dead. There is no through commerce. It usually is about 10 to 12 miles between origin and destination, and it's materials for building wing dams, the navigation system before the locks again.
Yeah.
So really, there's really no commerce. And so the Corps' argument is, why should we start another major project when the cities on the river aren't even building for it? And so, but the interesting thing about this one also is that it was tied to the Equity Cooperative elevator. Was the one, there was an elevator right behind it where these buildings are. And it was an effort by farmers, a farmer cooperative, the first farmer-owned terminal cooperative elevator in America was built here. And the idea was they wanted to bypass the grain traders in Minneapolis at all the mills and be able to sell directly to a cooperative. So the Equity Cooperative is established here, and it's a big battle between the, you know, the grain traders in Minneapolis and St. Paul. But it gets built, and if you heard of Senex now, what's the one that built the stadium back here? What? CHS. Those are all come from that line of that
Lake
Equity.
Lake Street, part of that too.
Yeah, the Equity Cooperative elevator comes from that. Was the one that started,
same
though.
Kind of organization that evolved, and Land O'Lakes was another outgrowth of that.
So this is where it started.
Yeah.
In western Minnesota, in the Dakotas as well.
Yeah. So sack house, loading by hand
just
kind of like the cotton bales down south or whatever.
Yeah, we have pictures of a ramp going down to a barge with a you know, like a wheeling cart with sacks of grain stacked on it, a and they would wheel those down to the barge and load it.
Wow.
So once they started to be able to use the elevator, they would load it directly down a chute into the barge.
Right. And a different style of barge then, too.
Oh, yeah, it was a covered barge.
Covered barge, yeah.
Hope you guys don't mind getting wet. For all those who canoed, you ever get wet?
Never.
I left my jacket in the car, so.
Well, you're under that. Some protection.
The only thing I don't want is lightning. So if we start getting that, then we're gonna get back.
Yeah.
Push it up a little bit. If we start putting up too much of a wake, let me know.
How much is too much?
I don't know. We'll start getting yard out by people over there. We're putting too much weight, but we're sitting lower in the water, so we're getting a little bit more of a wave. Joe, I'm going to push us up to about 2:30. If we're not there by then, we're going to turn around.
Right.
It'll be a quicker trip downriver because of the...
But yeah, that sounds good.
Let's can you throw one of these
over there?
Yeah, just set it to the side.
That one's okay there, so.
Is everybody familiar with the paddle share stations that we have?
No.
You aren't?
Yeah.
Oh, you are. So I don't
know. No, I'm not familiar. I said no.
So over there, you see that those yellow bins? So everybody knows about bike share, where you can check out a bike and ride to where you want it and check it back in. We paid for 60 of the nice ride stations in the Twin Cities through funding through the National Park Service. But then one of my people had the idea that, why don't we do a paddle share, a kayak share? So there's, normally there'd be kayaks on those, and you go online and you do a safety video, you get a key code, and you can go to one of those bins and check out a kayak, a paddle, and a life vest, and then you can take it out for $25 for 3 hours. And so we have four of them above the St. Anthony Falls. There's one at Hidden Falls, just upstream, and this is where you take out. So it's the first paddle share program in the country. And you can kayak downriver, check it back in, and then get a nice ride bike or a scooter or a Uber and go back to where you started. And you don't need to have your own kayak. You don't have to have someone shuttle you.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really easy system.
Yeah.
We're still piloting it. It is still in that piloting stage of trying to figure out how do we make it actually solvent
and
bring in money.
Yeah.
And then, I'm sorry, what? There's no paddle boards that I know of at Boom Island. It's just kayaks. There's a few two-person kayaks, but they're mostly single-person kayaks.
Mm-hmm. There's one at the MWMO office, right?
The Mississippi Watershed Management office, right by the Lowry Avenue Bridge, there's one.
Yeah.
North Mississippi Regional Park has one, River Park has one, and Boom Island.
Yeah. But Boom Island is more of a takeout spot, right?
Yeah, Boom Island's a takeout spot.
You don't want to go downstream from there.
So the climate change, the climate change matter here is that these stations that from Hidden Falls to Heard Island has been closed most of the year. The water's been too high to be safe, and we haven't made it available to people.
Yeah.
Yet that river above St. Anthony Falls, that's been open most of the year. So it's really it just doesn't have the same size basin, watershed, as does the Minnesota River, which accounts for most of our water.
What is the, I don't even know, what's the proportion flow typically between the Minnesota and the Mississippi? We should know that, shouldn't we?
I would say 3 or 4 to 1.
Really?
Is my guess.
Yeah, it's that.
So last spring, when it was flowing in about 40 CFS,
St. Anthony Falls right now.
Right, yeah, it's camping, it might be
a better proportion.
Yeah, right? I mean, it does fluctuate.
You know what the bellwether of that change is?
Yeah, the channel.
The top of Pike Island.
Yeah, because I've seen it going both ways.
Yeah. And I don't know where the rain came from, but we're going to get into that. I say, I didn't even bring my rain jacket.
I'll rent you mine for $15. Three beers. Or three beers.
Three beers.
Down at the sack house.
I trust that you actually have to immerse those life jackets in water before they, not just
right, wet. Right, not for me.
Something to think about.
Yep.
So this is a marina where we keep our boat. But we don't have one of the fancy covers.
Yeah, and that's where we launched in 2015.
Yeah, we did.
Right there.
Yep.
And we had about 6 or 8, I don't know, we probably had 20 feet of beach there.
Yeah. You know, when I pulled in the marina last weekend with the Great River Race, there were sandbars coming out from both sides of the marina. I was worried it might be too shallow even to get out.
Yeah.
And now it's come up substantially.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it must be 5 feet high now, at least 3 or 4 from what it was when we launched that a couple years ago. Yeah.
What's the situation with all the housing development along this side?
So what's with the housing along this side? This used to be that Austin Sack House that you see there. There used to be grain elevators all the way along here that were part of that. I mean, big rows of grain elevators. They tore down the grain elevators in the scrap yard at 1.2. Earlier there was a Little Italy.
Little Italy was here between 1880 and 1962 under the high bridge all the way down to the track house. Two villages in Italy where people would write letters if they'd gotten a job. It's a good place so they would come back. 1962 flood flooded them out finally and they moved just up into St. Paul. So then you had basically parking lots and other just kind of, I talked about it as kind of the river was the city's mugway. It wasn't the front door, it was the back door where you could sort of take off all the dirty stuff. And then starting in 2000, in 1999, the St. Paul Riverfront Corporation and the city of St. Paul started working on it. Basically, at the time, they had $150 million worth of new development there. And it's not all luxury. If you were there last night, you were hearing them talk about the luxury buildings. Those are the proposed buildings where that white wall is all across from there. These have some affordable housing and some basic market rates, some apartments and some kind of things. There's all range of things.
What I wanted to point out was the conversation last night, too, about that wall you see is where that big development is going to go.
Yeah.
The one with the big tower.
Right, yeah.
Well, imagine those huge towers right at that.
Is that the one that Morgan was talking about? Morgan. Adams
last night. Yeah. The picture she showed of that huge development is right where that big long wall is.
Yeah. It used to be the county jail.
And you'll see it as we get up here, past the bridge, and you look back, it'll be framed by the arch of this bridge. It's really kind of a beautiful photo. Yeah. But now imagine that new...
Right, with that huge thing. Is that a done deal at this point?
No, they have a lot.
They still got a ways to go. But,
So I don't know if people have heard me talk about this. Pat certainly has, but we were talking about how much flow difference there is between the Mississippi and the Minnesota above the confluence. But when I take people out on boat trips like this, or I'm on one of the paddle boats, I like to ask people how many Mississippi rivers there are in the Twin Cities. And it leads to puzzled looks. Pat knows exactly what I'm saying.
I know your answer.
Yeah, I know. People say, well, there's the Minnesota and the St. Croix and the Mississippi. And I say, no, how many Mississippis are there in the Twin Cities? And I tell them there's three. There's the large floodplain river, the big river that we're in, the river of Mark Twain, Image, Myth, and Metaphors, when Master's Thesis says. And you get to the confluence of the river, it'll go up the gorge.
Yeah.
8.5 miles. The bluffs are a third to a quarter mile apart, 80 to 100 feet high. Tightest, narrowest canyon on the river. The river drops, like I said last night, 110 feet from above St. Anthony down to the confluence. Mm-hmm. And then once you get above the falls, it's the Prairie River. And you saw there's banks, not bluffs. It's not a tight, narrow canyon. Buildings can build right up to the river's edge. There's not hardly any floodplain. So you know there's not a lot of flooding, because
Yeah.
I don't ever recall sandbagging above St. Anthony Falls. So no, it's no. So there's really three fundamentally different rivers.
Go ahead.
I'd say each one has been used differently, mm-hmm. and each one will respond to climate change and the Anthropocene reaction in different ways.
And those are three rivers defined by hydrology and geomorphology.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you define how many rivers there are by, say, sociocultural rivers, then it's an open question.
Sounds like a panel discussion.
Yeah. One Mississippi, two Mississippi, three Mississippi, four.
Well, I mean, you could go to infinite because literally there's sort of infinite numbers of people whose experiences are really different. But I love how this first station has sediment, which is how the river actually moves hydrologically, what rivers do is move mountains to the ocean.
Yeah.
Sediment. Settlement, whose river is it? Mm-hmm. That's just a subject that's up for debate in different ways in different communities. Mm-hmm. And then sentiment,
yeah,
is what does the river mean?
Yeah.
So you and I talked about that 1944 edition of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, where T.S. Eliot wrote, at what point does the Mississippi River become what the Mississippi River means?
Yeah.
And that's an interesting question, because that begs the question about what the Mississippi means and to whom.
Yeah. Certainly the stretch, even just the stretch we were in down in the Driftless last week, is not the Huck Finn's River.
Oh, no,
that's another kind of river down there, certainly, in terms of the geomorphology and the culture as well.
And those are guys who've taken pride in stopping at least two efforts to make the Mississippi River a national park.
Down there.
Yep. Yep. They'll tell you, if you get out in the communities, that they stopped it in the 1920s, Will Dill's effort to make it a national park that became a wildlife refuge. And then in the 1960s, when there was a heritage area, or 1990s, when there was a heritage corridor study, they stopped it because they say that was going to be a national park also. They saw that as the black helicopters coming in.
Very independent minded down in that neck of the woods.
Yeah, northeastern Iowa is really pushing hard for a national park along the Mississippi River. They did succeed in getting Effigy Mounds, however.
Yeah, right.
Effigy Mounds National Monument is there.
Yeah, relatively small scale.
But Will Dill, he started thinking about the park, but he quickly changed to the idea of a refuge. And it's a great story. He's Will Dill is a businessman from Chicago.
What's his name?
Will Dill, W-E-I-L-G. And Will Dill was out organizing. He's one of the founders of the Isaac Walton League. And so he's out on the Mississippi River organizing Isaac Walton League chapters. And at that time, the main navigation system in the 1920s is wing dams, which were actually borrowed from Germany, technology borrowed from Germany. Actually, they went, before the Corps started building wing dams, they sent a couple engineers to Germany to study the wing dams and how they were used. And so they...
Have we talked to our German friends about that particular connection, the wing dam, the German wing dam connection?
Henry Peter Bossy.
What?
Henry Peter Bossy.
He's got photographs
of it. Not Bossy, but the early engineers who went to Germany to study the use of these wing dams and brought that idea back here. We'll have to talk to... What's that?
I thought it was the roller dams.
No, there was both.
Okay.
There was both. So the roll dams were the corporation developed the roller dams that were put in the locks of it. But before that, it was the wing dams. And so Dill, ironically, is fishing off a wing dam. And he's trying to organize these chapters. He says, you know, Baldeo, we can make this whole thing a refuge. He's at Wabasha, Minnesota. We can make this whole thing a refuge. And the person who was with them wrote an article about it and said, there was no more organizing chapters, there was no more fishing, there was only making history. And he succeeded in 1924 of creating a 261-mile-long national wildlife and fish refuge on the Mississippi from Wabasha to Rock Island, which was kind of unheard of. And when he did it,
that's part of that refuge.
Don't leave back.
We were paddling, Winona to La Crosse.
So I'm gonna pick. Yeah. Now I'm gonna pick up the speed. We need to make some time. Yeah. It's gonna be harder to talk, especially for me. So yeah. I'm gonna pick up some speed here. Hang on. We'll never make Lochinvar one.
Yeah.
contaminated by water too much. And there's also ash trees through here, emerald ash borer and invasive beetle. It's killing off all our ash trees.
We have the same in England.
Yeah.
Okay. I think we may have put it for you.
No way. Sure, it was the other way around. No, it's, I'm not sure where it came from, but it started spreading from New York this way. So I know up by Fort Snelling near the confluence of the two rivers, the Minnesota Mississippi, you can start seeing many, many more of the ash trees that are dying off. Impact be, and so the Corps kind of backed off on that. And but then the next thing I heard was that the Corps wanted to change now the definition of emergency dredging. So what constitutes an emergency dredging? They want to kind of redefine that. And so what I, you know, what I told my staff is what you're seeing.
I'm assuming to expand the definition, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And because there, you know, is an emergency. An economic emergency where the barge line industries aren't making enough money, and that's the emergency.
Right,
or
right.
Could the barges load half full and still make it? And so, I mean, and the barge industry is certainly affected by this high water. They have been.
Yeah.
But what I told my staff is, I said, what you are seeing here is the Corps' recognition of the long-term impact of climate change.
Right.
And that the Corps is finally saying, approach this year to year. We need a long-term solution that acknowledges the new norm.
Yeah.
And so now they're trying to figure that out.
Yeah. It's sort of like the long, slow emergency in a way, right?
Yeah.
This idea that if there's so much sediment going down, then they will be, in effect, kind of overwhelmed, right? Or constantly stretched to keep up.
Yeah.
Then is it a matter of increasing their overall dredging capacity by 20%, you know,
yeah.
number of rigs, the number of, you know, pumps, all of that stuff, or what?
Yeah, they're having a hard time right now finding dredge placement sites.
Right, I know, that's the other thing, you got to put this stuff somewhere.
Yeah, so.
It's getting harder and harder to, remember there was some farm right downstream from Wabasha, you know, because that's such a heavy sediment deposit there. And I think they lost that, the Corps lost that battle, right? They were basically gonna, you know, bury somebody's farm field there just downstream from Wabasha, and they did not get that.
Yeah, they're still working on that and trying to figure it out, and they're even talking eminent domain.
Not gonna win him any friends.
Well,
but yeah.
One of my introduction to the Corps of Engineers was I was walking into this training, into this office by this conference room, and there's just partitions dividing the hallway from the conference room. And this guy was on the other side of the partition. He goes, "What do you mean it's not gonna impact my farm? It's gonna be 20 feet underwater." And so I was like, the Corps has had those conversations for years.
That was a dam building project.
But what it shows, I mean, I thought the Corps' requests this year were kind of a benchmark for what is happening with climate change and the new norm on the Mississippi, and how do we manage it for, you know, navigation going into the future.
Keep
it sustainable. Because if the barges have to half load, you know, they would, their, you know, their argument is economies of scale.
It unbalances that constant, right?
Yeah.
You know, which one is going to be more efficient?
So we are approaching the confluence of the Minnesota and Mississippi rivers.
Yeah.
To the right is the Mississippi, and to the left is the Minnesota. Pike Island is right in front of us, dead center.
So Emily, the two Emily. So this is at Bedonte here, where we hike down. About a week ago, we did a hike down.
Look at them, you can see the mixing of the waters.
Oh yeah, there's the confluence line.
You see the brown tan sediment from the Minnesota River coming in on the left? And on the right, it's clearer. You stand up, you can see it better. So this is a confluence of the two rivers, but the Minnesota brings in so much more sediment that it's clearly visible. And I'm
kind of in a little patch. I see some of it actually over there. I think we're more in the Minnesota at the moment.
Actually, if you look on the right, you can't hardly see it.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna go a little bit this way and see if you can see it a little more.
So this is like the island that we hiked around.
Yep. And you know we walked out onto the sand spit there at the very tip.
Yeah.
And that's underwater now.
Yeah, it was like, what? I don't
know. Yeah, somebody posted that in the field notes about a boat in the
We'll kick it back up again.
Yeah.
So everybody grab something, hold something, steady yourself. So I don't know if I'm going to make it all the way up.
Yeah, we're getting close.
We got a late start.
Get the dam or...
Well, I'll watch it up there. I think you wait a little bit from the other end.
Yeah.
Well, see, we should be up there in 7 minutes. We'll turn on at 2:30 and head back. We'll go with the current. Say, Pat, will you just take a look at that gas tank behind you? Let me know what the level on it is. It's over the edge. Look back by the engine
behind.
I can see it out there a little bit more.
Yeah.
I can't tell what the level is. Where do you see the level?
There's a little gauge on it. There should be a little gauge.
Oh. Yeah, this one here. Yeah.
All right. It's about half.
About half.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
okay. That's what I was hoping.
Both guys. Land guys, my bicycle doesn't have a gas gauge. I don't know how to work that. Now, Joe, you pointed this out as a joke thing. The joke thing.